I tell people all the time that I didn't write the book. Vinny wrote the book. I was possessed. Like, Vinny was an emotional free write that just so happened to work out.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Preston Clark, author of the award-winning novel, Vinny, A Love Letter. On this episode, Preston explains why he wanted to use the story of a 14-year-old Black boy to deconstruct toxic masculinity.
We give so much power to other men. I don't care what you think, because the true definition of masculinity is you can't knock me off my path. I don't care what your opinion is. Like, you literally do not matter to me. And once I got to that space, I've been unstoppable.
Preston is a former sports journalist and prolific poet originally from San Diego. He now lives in Chicago, where he teaches humanities at Urban Prep Charter Academy, an all-boys school in the heart of the South Side. In our conversation, Preston opens up about why he says the man he is now is a miracle. The personal tragedies he experienced that led him to finish the manuscript he'd been working on for 2 years in 2 months. And what it means for him to meet and teach young Black boys like his character who've never seen themselves represented in a book. That and more when Black and Published continues. And as a warning, this episode includes sensitive topics, including a discussion of self-harm. Please be gentle with and on yourself while listening.
All right, so my first question, when did you know that you were a writer?
Oh, wow. I was writing since first grade. I still remember my very first story was called The Dead Man's Foot Comes Back. And my teacher let me read it because I was a big Goosebumps fan. But the moment that I realized I was going to truly write as an adult was my senior year in high school. We had an assignment in our English class, and we were supposed to start a novel, just write the first few sentences of starting a novel, but get right into it. And so I wrote mine about a girl losing her virginity. And I wrote like three sentences, and I read it in class, and I read it with my head down. And when I put my head up, the whole room just jaws were on the floor. And I was like, that was good. And everybody was like, yeah. And then my teacher was like, can you make that longer? And so I wrote a short story called Our Eyes Met. It was like this one page short story. And I read it in class because she said, if you keep writing these short stories, you can get extra credit. And so I started writing short stories for class. And that kind of really kind of got my creative pen moving. And it hasn't stopped since.
So in senior year in high school, you realized that writing was a thing that you wanted to do with the short story that you wrote. So then where did that path take you?
Well, when I left high school for college at Hampton University, shout out to HU, I joined a creative writing group called Spark One, but they were all poets. And I was the curveball of the group because I was writing short stories. But all of them kept saying, you know, if you strip the language of your short stories, you have a poem. You're just a narrative poet. So I kept kind of working at it. And we had this event on campus, this AIDS awareness event. And it was the first time I ever had to write a poem, edit a poem, and memorize a poem. And still to this day, it has my favorite line I ever wrote as a poet, which is, as our words intertwine and our hearts crisscross, Christ christened our combination, the second coming of Adam and Eve. And it's still my favorite line I ever wrote as a poet. And I went the poetry route the rest of my college years. And then when I came home to San Diego, me and some friends from college came out with a book called The Left Side Poets Present Strange Fruit. And it came out in 2011. And this was back when the National Underground Spoken Word Poetry Awards were still around. And we actually won Poetry Book of the Year. So I went from poetry, my degrees in journalism. So I did a lot of sports writing. And so I left New Jersey, which was where I lived after college. I left New Jersey, moved back to San Diego to pursue screenwriting. Then I hosted an open mic for 4 years, which was amazing. I was on the 2013 Elevated Slam team out of San Diego that finished fourth in the country at Nationals. So I had basically gotten close and done some good things in some various spaces, but it wasn't until I started writing Vinny a Love Letter in November of 2015 that I really truly find what all that other writing was truly going to lead me to. And that was my novel. So it was a long stretch. I didn't really find who I was as a writer till my 30s. 29. But once I did, it's been nothing but prose since.
What do you mean by that you didn't find yourself as a writer until your 20s?
Well, I mean, my degree was in journalism. I left that. I had pursued the screenwriting thing and I kept getting close. But with screenwriting, it's the industry so fickle. Unless something gets signed on a dotted line, you know, it's not, nothing's guaranteed. And then poetry, I was good at it. But when I went to Nationals in Boston, and I went to this thing called New Pick, which is the night before final stage at Nationals, they have like this this tournament style one-on-one kind of thing where it's two poets spit their poems and then the crowd votes for it. So it's a really kind of gutter kind of version of what we've been doing. And I'm seeing some of the best writing, some of the best performing I've ever seen in my life. And I realized at that moment, I don't love poetry enough to get to that level. Like, I liked it. It was good. It was fun. But I didn't love it enough to get to that level. So the journalism, the screenwriting, and the poetry, like, none of them hit at the level that I really wanted them to. And then when I started writing my book, I realized that all the other three styles all led me to what I ended up writing. Because the journalism made me a strong editor. It made me a strong researcher. The screenwriting made me good with dialogue. It made me good with setting a scene. And then the poetry, I basically call my prose spoken word prose because it has a poetic rhythm to it. It's a lyrical rhythm to it. So all three of those combined with my narrative storytelling abilities turned into what my voice ended up being as a prose writer.
What made you decide to want to write this story about a 14-year-old boy?
Vinny is a character in a previous screenplay I wrote. But he was a secondary character in that screenplay. And so I always wanted to do something with Vinny. And I thought it was going to be another screenplay with just him. But when a friend of mine, Erica Buddington, who does everything I do but better, she's an educator, she's a poet, she's a writer, she's phenomenal. She had a website and she was looking for guest fiction writers. And this was in late 2015. And I was like, yo, that seems like something cool to do because she was going to print a novella for you at the end of the process. But you basically were going to write a chapter of your book every week. She would post it to her website until you were done. And so I hit her up and I actually sent her a different story. But because she's an educator, she liked to keep her page PG-13. And mine was like an immediate sex scene. And so she was like, I would love to use you, but can you give me something else? And I was like, I don't know. I didn't have anything ready. I didn't know what to do. And the one part of this story I still don't remember is I don't know what made me decide to use Vinny. I do not know what the moment was or anything, but I already had the skeleton of his story because of the screenplay. And so all I had to do was fill it in and kind of stretch it out. And I sent her what ended up being chapter one of the book. And I sent it to Erica and she said, yes, let's do this. And so I wrote for her site for about 16 chapters. She got rid of the site and I was like, can I start my own website with the story? And she was like, oh, yeah, sure. Started writing on the new website. But then I was like, I don't want to give the whole story for free. So I stopped writing on the website and started paying attention to actually writing the book and ended up with the book by May of 2018.
So you started Vinny in May 2015 and finished it in 2018?
Yes, I started in November 2015 and I finished in May 26, 2018.
Very specific that you remember those dates.
Yeah, because of what ended up what led to me finishing it is why the dates are so significant.
Okay, so what led to you finishing the book?
So I wrote about 27,000 words from 2015, from November 2015 to March of 2018, which isn't a lot. And a part of it was I didn't have the support at the time from a particular entity that I needed to continue the writing. But then two really emotional events happened to me in around February of 2018. A 5-year odyssey with a woman ended, and we also were mourning a miscarriage. And so, but we didn't get to mourn the miscarriage together. So I had these two painful events occur, and I needed somewhere to put my emotional energy or I was going to fall apart. And writing is always where I go when I'm in pain. And so I said, I'm going to finish my book. So I wrote 45,000 words in 2 months. So I started writing March 22nd, 2018 to May 26, 2018. And my friends, my family, everybody knew that every day after work, I was writing. I was possessed. Like I went into a very dark space and stayed there because I write the best from pain and or when I'm angry. And I didn't have to find, I was always in pain for that 2-month stretch because of what I had just gone through. So I didn't have to manufacture the pain at all. The pain was there. And so I just had to manipulate it into a positive direction. And that's what turned into the book. Because you don't get the last the last 160 pages are that 2 months. So a lot of what I ended up writing during that portion doesn't happen if the two emotional events don't happen. So literally my personal life, at least the energy from my personal life, can be seen all throughout that book from that stretch of time in my life. So that's why it's always fascinating when I go back and read it, because it just reminds me of what I dealt with and what I went through. But I wouldn't change any of it, because if I change any of it, I don't have the same book. And the book is what I needed.
You self-published, Vinny, and you said you finished the book May 26, 2018, and that you self-published the first edition September 11, 2018. Why did you want to self-publish?
I actually shopped it to agents for a short period. And I kept getting, I got some no's. And I ended up deciding to self-publish it because it was almost like, you know how our favorite musical artists, it seems like their first album's the most pure one. It's like it's the most raw. Yeah. And it's like the one that they end up chasing the rest of their career. I felt like that with this, where by self-publishing it, I had complete control over what words were going to be in it. Aside from me having the three editors I had, they didn't touch me stylistically. It was more proofreading, more story editing. And then I had what I call emotion editors, where basically I had friends who read the story and they tracked their emotional journey in notes. So I could see what response the book was getting. But yeah, I decided to do it myself. Just the process was amazing. And I just felt like knowing what it took to do the marketing, to do the editing, to just going through the whole process. Once I started printing traditionally, I would have a better grasp of the conversations I was going to end up having with my agent, with publishing houses, with those type of entities. So I think it was meant to be for me to print this out the first time on its own and self-published, because now it's mine forever. And so we have the first edition, and then I won my award, which is the reason why we printed the second edition.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We got to get to the book to get to the reading. So if you could read a little bit of something from Vinny for the audience, and then I have pages and pages of questions for you about this book.
Absolutely.
Hey, Black and Published family. It's time for the reading. Here's a quick description about Preston's novel, Vinny, A Love Letter. As you've heard, the novel follows 14-year-old Vinny Smith. After a tragic loss in his life, he tries to fill the void with people he wants to love, but who don't know how to love him back. A reality that brings him to the brink of a breakdown. Here's Preston.
Okay, we'll do this then. I run my finger against its edges. It does not cut, but it does create a precursor against my skin. Teasing it with its capabilities, it calls out for it like Amsterdam red light district window shopping. It is erotic in nature, bliss in nurture. It is getting harder and harder to say no to its constant yearning. I can hear its loins palpitating with a sharpness all its own. It is sexy in this moment, a sexually deviant partner for which I am not strong enough to avoid much longer. My legs shake. The hair on my arms stick up like hundreds of black men at the sound of police sirens. I tap the box cutter against the hardwood floor. It tap dances to a rhythm of silent screams from the vocal cords of men whose emotional outcries were muted by the very women who asked to hear them in the first place. It craves my skin at this time, and Baldwin can do nothing about it. All he can do is hope I pull through this maze of emotions better in the long run, but even the greats have to take a step back every once in a while to delve into decadence to get reminded of just how fragile this humanity of ours is. I know pain. My knuckles still stained with the memories of the force it takes to dent my bedroom walls repeatedly, but I do not know a pain quite like this one. This one is intimate, eloquent, passionate. It is a pain subtle in its execution, explosive in its response. It is like taking drugs for the first time, only to find out that you have been hooked on drugs all along. But black men don't cut. I can hear my father's ego slither into my eardrums with his stereotypical jargon about what a black man is. To cut in the black community is to succumb to the white man's way of coping, almost like we succumb to the white man's religious beliefs, but no one likes to talk about that, or to his education system, or to his aesthetic, or to his criticism of the arts, or to his hypocrisy. Nah, we have enough hypocrisy on our own to not need his. Do not tell me how I'm supposed to handle my pain when you are the one who hurt me in the first place. You do not get to select my bandages when you are the one who made me bleed. It does not work that way. It will not work that way. It will work how I want it to work. And now I want this box cutter to please me. I wanted to make love to my insecurities and blanket my dreams with thoughts of irrefutable bliss. I wanted to take turns enticing my ego with its violence, destroy my self-esteem and leave it on the basement floor in shambles, only to be gobbled back up when I come to. I want this ecstasy to drip from my lips with rabid flow, now river mode, drown me in its waves of complications. I want to feel like Stockholm syndrome. I want to yearn for its rapture despite my capture. I want it to save me. I want it to love me. I want to be one with its intricacies, an enemy with a pass for entry. I want it to be a father I can control. I cannot control my tears. I cannot control my fears. I cannot say no any longer. I place the box cutter to my wrist, tap dance and interlude against my skin and slowly cut. Oh, it hurts, but it hurts properly. It is what I have wanted all my life. Blood drips in opposite directions, stains the bathroom floor with its colorful texture. It writes my name in colored ink. Cursive, the writing of creatives, creatively dispersed among this concrete floor. It opens its mouth for more, but I am not ready to supply it. Right now, all I want to do is bask in the ambiance that is the scent of my own blood and wait for a father who will never reach me in time.
All right. So my first question for you, and I'm going to read it from my notes, is, and this exploration of what it means to be a man, there's also a searing indictment of toxic masculinity, Christianity as it was given and indoctrinated into people of color, and white supremacy in the ways Black people have adopted it, perverted it, and made it our own. Was it your intention to tackle all of these heavy subjects, including the pull of suicide, in the story of 14-year-old Vinny who deals with the loss of his mother and an absentee father?
No. Yo, I'm so serious. I tell people all the time that I didn't write the book. Vinny wrote the book. I was just the vessel necessary for him to get a story on the page. He says stuff I would never say.
Yeah.
He thinks things I would never think, which allowed me to, I write from my shadow. From my shadow self. And so it allows for me not to mute my own words. It allows me to not be worried about what others are going to say or think. The fact that he thinks that God is a she, is a conversation that I used to have arguments with people close to me about. And so it was just a freedom that he provided me. And the mistakes I made during the writing or during the period of time that I was writing the story from 2015 to 2018 and my own personal examination of toxic masculinity and how much it was impacting my own personal journey and my own existence. It was great to explore it through the eyes of a 14-year-old because I kept asking myself, what would I have wanted to know about masculinity and the negative impact it could potentially have at that age? Because if I would have known the things I know now, then I wouldn't have made the mistakes I made as an adult. Mm. And so that's really where it came from, because I had been referred to or called names that fed into the toxically masculine stereotypes of weakness and things of that nature. And so it put me into a mental space of, like, I need somewhere safe to respond to the critics, to the naysayers. And I found it in these pages. And so none of it was on purpose. Mm. It just happened. Vinny was an emotional free write that just so happened to work out.
Hmm. So then what does that character possession feel like in the moment?
Oh, it's emotionally draining. I'm physically tired. I didn't write a lot because it was so draining. Like, it wasn't something I could in that first 2.5 years. It wasn't something I could do every day because it would impact me. But because I felt like I had lost so much after those two events happened, I didn't care. So I let all my friends and family know, like, I'm not going to be myself these next 2 months. Like, I'm not going to be myself until this book is done. I had the same exact playlist every single time I sat down to write. I mostly wrote from my mom's den in the dark with my laptop. I had a very specific space I needed to get into in order to channel him. And I'll never forget when I sat down, I wrote the last pages on May 26th. And because one of my dear friends, Amon Ra, and my cousin Ian were going to meet me at Office Depot for me to print it out for the first time. And so I was like, I'm going to finish it this morning. I'll get at y'all later on. And the last scene of the book is also the last scene in the film, at least of Vinny. And I pulled out the script and tried to just rewrite the script. And it was coming out disgusting. I was like, ugh, this is terrible. I'm like, I can't end the book like this. And I wrote like maybe 4 or 5 drafts and then I deleted all of it. And I literally sat there, closed my eyes and said, Vinny, edit this. And then I spazzed in the last 10 pages. And I actually had a different ending in mind. Vinny told me to stop where I stopped. And I was like, ooh, people gonna be mad. And he was like, I don't care. And so we left it where it was. and now I have that last 10 pages, and those last 10 pages are some of the best pages I've ever written.
I can't say I was mad at the ending. Just because my first book ends on a cliffhanger intentionally. Mm-hmm. And then it picks right back up in the second book. Mm-hmm. But I like the ending, and I was like, okay, the book is over now. It's his story is done, at least for now. Mm. But I guess what I want to get into is, because you said that you were learning about toxic masculinity and some of the mistakes you made as a man, if you had known about certain things earlier, you wouldn't have made them. So what mistakes from your own personal life were you trying to correct in the text of Vinny?
Shoot. it might be another podcast worth. I grew up in, you know, the same misogynistic environment that, you know, that my friends and family grew up in. My father is a misogynist, bigot, narcissist, sexist, terrible human being. And I knew that all my flaws were his. The difference between the two of us was that I saw them as flaws and was willing to work towards changing those things. And so the man I am now is a miracle. But it took time. So I get to college and I came from a space of homophobia. I get to college, I meet some of the most amazing men I ever met in my life. And I find out after the fact, they're homosexual. And so I'm like, well, that's not going to change the fact that this dude is super cool and we boys. And so that was the beginning of that journey. Me getting called out by dear friends of mine for things that left my mouth and me actually listening led to my change. People handed me books. Bell Hooks' The Will to Change changed my life. It was the first time I looked at it from an academic perspective of just how much programming Black men get from a very, very young age. A lot of the things I believed, I didn't even know why or when or how those beliefs even came about. And so I made mistakes in relationships. I didn't know really who I was. And I got to see the worst of me in that situation. And I never want to see that man again. Mm. And I work every day to make sure that I don't. And so because of my refusal to be that person, I'm much more engaged with self-reflection. I'm really big on self-care. I'm really big on positive masculinity models. I'm really big on literacy. And it shows up when I teach because, you know, as you know, I teach at an all Black male high school. So I can't tell them what I'm not. So I had to go through a process. And it was a painful process. There was a lot of tears and even made mistakes during the process. but I'm very, very proud of the man I am now. And part of that process was the writing of this book and getting it on page and getting the discussion started around some of these very, very serious topics that unfortunately a lot of men, specifically Black men, don't talk about.
In the book, Vinny has a best friend, a white best friend, who's a boy, Walter. And there's a lot that happens in their relationship. So without spoiling it, you say on page 70, and this is Vinny talking about Walter, "I do not think he wants to kiss me either, but if he did, I would smile and engage him. Vinny declares the friendly love between him and Walter multiple times. He's even open to kissing him. Why was it important for you to write male characters showing each other love that is non-sexual?"
Because we don't see it. And it's not allowed, quote unquote. Teaching young people for as long as I've taught, unfortunately, previous generations have taught this generation to still refer to certain behaviors or certain exterior visuals as gay. And literally the only criteria for homosexuality is who you're attracted to. And yet still people with people's clothing, with people's voices, with how people walk, all these other things, and people will automatically assume homosexuality when some of the most stereotypically masculine men on the planet can be gay. And so I really wanted to kind of open that conversation, as well as I've gotten older, me and my friends, we're big on "I love you." We're big on showing affection. When we get off the phone, we say, "I love you, bro." Like, because we do. We literally talk to each other all the time. We literally want to hang out. We want to spend time. Like, that's love. So why can't we actually say it out loud? And I actually taught the book to my 10th graders 3 years ago. And it was a room full of Black boys who were 15, 16 years old. And one of their first questions, "Mr. Clark, Vinny gay?" I was like, "No. Why do you think so?" My whole thing was, I want you to question why you are questioning. because she clearly likes girls. He clearly talks about girls. He clearly shows affection towards girls. He clearly has interest in girls. He just happens to be very affectionate with his best friend. So where is the gayness coming from for you? And I want people to have that internal conversation and ask themselves why they feel that way. Because a lot of times people don't know why they do. And hopefully the book will force you to actually have that conversation with yourself.
Vinny does like and is interested in girls. And even though this book is very, very male energy dominated, masculine dominated, you know, there's the essence of his mother, there's the essence of his grandmother, but it's the one girl, Janae, who I think is the most complete as a female character. And she's, I think he's talking about her on page 169. He says, "You get why that pain can be so real for a girl whose life had to be seen as make-believe in order for her to live it," which I was just like, whoa, I had to read that sentence like two or three different times. "Was it easy for you to craft this young Black girl to be Vinny's, you know, compliment?"
I grew up, I have a younger sister, older sister, mom, and that was my crew. So I come from a very feminine energy space. And as I got older, friends like my friend Amin Ra and others started having conversations around divine femininity. And it was almost parallel to toxic masculinity. And so we were looking at both of these new to us, or at least this terminology that was new to us at the same time, which allowed for us to start to have some interesting conversations. Because I started looking at it, I was like, dude, the best version of myself actually has a lot of feminine qualities, or traditionally feminine qualities. When I started doing self-care and being okay with my house being full of candles, being okay with the fact that I like to do a bath bomb every Friday and I have a glass of wine and a bath bomb playlist. Like all these things that when I was younger, I would have cared what another man thought, which always is like, this is the weirdest thing. We give so much power to other men. I don't care what you think, because the true definition of masculinity is you can't knock me off my path. I don't care what your opinion is. Like, you literally do not matter to me. And once I got to that space, I've been unstoppable, because now I'm so comfortable in my own skin. I stopped fighting who I really was, trying to be somebody who was from my neighborhood, you know, somebody who, knowing good and well, I'm a preppy who likes sweet alcohol drinks. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't, it's like, it is what it is. As I'm talking to you right now, I'm drinking what I call a ghetto mimosa, which is Moscato and lemonade. Like, it is what it is. You know what I'm saying?
No judgment.
I finally got to this certain level of comfort with myself that I never had in my entire life. And Vinny is a true testament to that, in that men can come in so many different forms. Women are allowed to be free in their expression of who they are, in my personal opinion. Now, yes, you get judged for, you know, aesthetics and things of that nature. But women are more likely to say, I don't care what you think. Dudes have literally adjusted who they completely are for the satisfaction of some other people. And I'm like, that's whack. And then when I realized that the people who love me either way, then I really didn't care. I was like, oh, I'm free to do whatever I want anyway. And that's been a powerful, powerful space to live in.
So it makes me feel like that Vinny's father, who was another very central character to this book, is the embodiment of a man who cares what everyone else thinks. And he has to unlearn that in some ways. And he falters, as all people do when they're unlearning toxic behavior. And I think it's best shown in like how he has his relationship to like his work and his son, and is very separate. And he looks at, you know, I go to work, I provide. What else do you want from me? This should be enough. Why do you think that some men choose that particular route of showing their love, their care, their emotion, their affection with their spouses and their children, instead of actually giving over to their more emotional, more feminine tendencies?
It's easier. One of my friends in college said, men are economists. We do the absolute minimum of what it for whatever it is we're trying to accomplish. So if all you're trying to accomplish is that I'm a good father, and you feel like the bare minimum for that is to just provide financially, then that's what you're going to do. Now, what I love is that the generation of fathers that I'm a part of, I'm not a father myself, but watching my friends raise their children with so much more affection than we got, it's beautiful to see. And I got 6'4", 6'5", you know, 230-pound black men who are absolute puddles around their kids. And it's like, this is what we're supposed to be. This is beautiful. This is great to see. Men being more open to crying, to showing emotion, to being tearful. And Thomas is the perfect parallel because he represents everything that we think fatherhood, that we only think fatherhood needs to be. But then he runs into a son who needs the one thing that us as men aren't trained to do, which is to be emotionally connected, to be affectionate, to be loving, to be caring, without it speaking specifically to providing or financial. But what if your child needs more than that? Mm-hmm. And Vinny was willing to go to any lengths to be able to get that love from his father. And so his father had to make a choice whether or not he was willing to do so.
What do you want readers to get out of this book? Because you mentioned that you've taught it to your 10th, 11th grade classes at Urban Prep in Chicago. What do you want your students and readers in general just to get from this book, from this about this boy?
Well, first, I said it before, I want you to question your questioning. That's one of my big things. I want you to question why you are reacting the way you are to what you are reading in these pages. And I want you to see a black boy that goes against the status quo. He's extremely intelligent. He's a painter. He's an athlete who doesn't like athletics, which some of my favorite scenes are watching him be an athlete and the people around him are mad he won't pursue it. And he was like, just because I'm good at it doesn't mean I have to be this. And how many black males have actually said that have been good at a sport, but then decided not to pursue it? Like, that's so, so rare. And then just like, I want people to read it and feel free to just be. Like, if this 14-year-old boy can be this secure in who he is. And the funny thing about Vinny is that as intelligent as he is, he's still naive to a lot. He's both fighting toxic masculinity while also exhibiting a lot of toxic masculinity's issues. And so it's this constant battle. And that's what a lot of us are dealing with. And so either the book is going to reaffirm your belief systems, or it's going to challenge your belief systems. And either way it goes, it's still a journey. But what's crazy is I wrote a book with a lead character who cuts. And I hadn't met any black men who had until after I wrote the book, I ran into some teenagers who did.
Wow.
And they were like, I've never seen myself in any literature. I'm like, I haven't seen you in real life.
Wow.
So, you know what I mean? So it's like, when I tell you that this was a spiritual experience for me and an out-of-body experience for me, is because the majority of the words on the paper were not planned. They were not, the whole process, the whole finished product is what it was supposed to be, not what I wanted it to be.
Mm.
And I think as writers, sometimes we have to be very aware of that fact, that the story is the story. The characters are the characters. And when your characters start operating outside of what you want them to do, that's when you truly have something.
All right. So then I want to go into a little speed round with you and a little game before we end our interview for today.
Sounds good.
I feel like I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask anyway for those who don't know you and haven't read the book.
I already know what question's coming. James Baldwin.
What is your favorite book?
We're
going to get to that.
Oh, my favorite book.
What is your favorite book?
Ooh,
yes, first.
That's actually a difficult question. I don't necessarily have one. I definitely have a favorite writer. So I'll just use my favorite book by my favorite writer, Another Country, James Baldwin.
And your favorite author is?
James Baldwin, who is the greatest writer to ever live, period. William Shakespeare, if he gets my bond.
We're not at that part of the interview yet where we shade other writers. What is your favorite song?
I Want to Be Your Man by Zapp and Roger.
Who is your favorite artist?
Basquiat.
Since you have this screenwriting background, what do you think is the best book to movie adaptation and why?
Ooh, book to movie adaptation?
Or book to TV show adaptation.
Oh, okay, you changed the question. All right, so because book to TV is Lovecraft Country.
Yeah.
With you right on its tail. Book to movie, A Time to Kill. And I say that because it's one of the few where the movie rivaled the book. Most of the time, the book just utterly slaughters everything else.
If money were no option, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
Bali, Indonesia. I would write every day. One of my dreams is to pause my existence, travel the world for a year, and write four books. And I'm currently in the process of putting myself in a position to absolutely accomplish that.
What is your hidden talent?
Oh, shoot. Well, I used to be a really good basketball player when I was younger. So that's not hidden to people who grew up with me, but people who know me as an adult don't know that I was a really good shooter as a basketball player. But I'm 5'6". So when all my friends got taller than me, things changed.
Yeah, I see how that works out.
Yeah.
All right. So my little game is called Rewriting the Classics. What's the one book you wish you would have written?
Ooh, one book I wish I would have written.
Mm-hmm.
If Bill Street Could Talk.
What's one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
Oh my God. I would change the ending to Coldest Winter Ever.
Wow.
I'd keep going. I wouldn't stop.
Well, you know the second part of that story is now out.
Yeah.
Winter Story.
Yeah, 30 years later.
All right. And my final question for Rewriting the Classics. Name a book that you think is overrated and why?
Oh my gosh, this is easy because I can't stand the literary canon. All right, I'll give you a whole list. Scarlet Letter, Nathaniel Hawthorne, terrible. Grapes of Wrath, trash. What else? What else is terrible? No, I like that one. I like that one. Majority of Shakespeare. What else? Don't even get me started on freaking. Because the thing is that old white dudes who think that they're the best writers on the planet, when my Mount Rushmore is Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, Juno Diaz, and Colson Whitehead is now trying to find him a spot on there because Colson Whitehead to me is the best novelist in the country right now. But yeah, Grapes of Wrath, Throw It Away, Scarlet Letter. I'm like, why are we reading about this adulterous lady in the middle of my 11th grade year? What's the other one? The Crucible, trash. What else you want? Yeah, basically all them books that we had to read in honors English classes in freaking high school. It was like, dude, I want to sleep. We can't read no Baldwin in here. We can't read some Octavia Butler in here. Like, it's annoying. You ended it with, that got my eyebrow furrowed over here in these streets. I'm like,
you are not the first person to say the entire literary canon.
Bruh.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
So my final question for Black and Published today, it's a serious question, but I can't stop laughing. All right, let me compose myself. All right. When you're dead and gone,
What would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
That I was honest, unpredictable. I was a James Baldwin protege without you knowing that he's my favorite writer. And I want my legacy to simply be, it's never too late to be great. Because I've said to myself on so many occasions, I'm the best writer nobody knows about. And so eventually people will know.
Thank you, Preston.
Yes, ma'am.
Big thank you to Preston Clark for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out his debut novel, Vinny, A Love Letter. Out now, everywhere books are sold. And if you're not following Preston, follow him on the socials. He's at @rprestonclark on Twitter and Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Preston about the award he won for his debut novel, which was self-published. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holla at y'all next week when our guest will be Mark Curtis Little, author of the novel The Bootlegger's Mistress. Until then, peace.